A few things before we get into this week's episode. First of all, we hope everyone is staying safe during these uncertain and, quite frankly, scary times. And please, wash those hands. Also, we'd like to ask y'all to stick around to the end to hear a trailer for our good buddy Steve's podcast, Fascination Street. Steve interviews all kinds of immensely interesting folks from virtually any walk of life that you can think of. Actors, directors, musicians, entrepreneurs, and pretty much everything else in between. If you're a longtime Gone Cold listener, you'll no doubt be interested to hear Steve's amazing interview with retired LA County Sheriff's Office homicide investigator turned detective novelist, Danny Smith. He's also interviewed our friend Lainey from the True Crime Fan Club podcast, which is also pretty great. So anyway, please stick around to the end to hear a trailer for Fascination Street. Now on to the episode.
The Gone Cold podcast may contain violent or graphic subject matter. Listener discretion is advised.
Early in the morning of Saturday, September 20th, 1975, two fishermen cast their lines in Austin, Texas's Town Lake, known as Lady Bird Lake today, named, of course, after Lady Bird Johnson, the former First Lady and wife of the 36th President of the United States. As the men fished, something out of place caught their attention. The body of a woman, fully clothed, floated face down in the water. After an autopsy, it was reported that the woman, determined to be in her mid-20s, had drowned, judging by the water found in her stomach and lungs. Austin police attempted to identify the woman through the newspaper and by checking with nearby agencies for missing persons who fit her description. She was 5 feet 3 inches tall, weighed around 125 pounds, had reddish blonde hair, and wore maroon corduroy pants and a green sweater. A couple days later, when the local paper, the Austin American Statesman, got a call from an Austin police detective who wished to remain unnamed, the case erupted into a small and short-lived controversy. The anonymous detective told the newspaper that the drowned woman's body had been weighted down with a block of concrete, a detail police had left out during press briefings. The American Statesman was none too pleased about this omission and claimed cover-up. They found the department's lack of disclosure worrisome, mostly due to a still fresh suicide ruling less than a year earlier in the questionable death of an Austin man in an unrelated case. Austin Police Homicide Lieutenant Colin Jordan reasonably responded to the allegations.
"I've withheld information on every damn murder case in hopes of giving a suspect as fair and impartial a trial as possible."
Though his supervisor, Captain Bob Parsons, claimed that the death had, quote, every indication it was suicide.
"Until I can prove otherwise, I look at every death as a murder," Lieutenant Jordan said.
The concrete block had been tied around the unidentified woman's waist with a towel and twine. It was noticeable, even in print, that Lieutenant Jordan was frustrated to the point of anger with both his captain's early determination that this woman had tied a weight to herself and jumped into the lake to commit suicide, and with the newspaper's attempts to sensationalize the death.
"My primary concern is to get her identified," he told reporters,
refusing to confirm or deny any details at all beyond her description. Police checked out reports of at least 15 possible identities, including a few at Armadillo World headquarters, a bar, music venue, and an incubator and star maker of country and southern rock musicians. The Jane Doe became known to detectives as the Lady in the Lake, and her story disappeared from print, along with the Austin American Statesman's controversy surrounding a police cover-up. 5 years before Austin's Lady in the Lake, 50 miles northwest in Kingsland, another Lady in the Lake mystery unfolded, in Lake Lyndon Baines Johnson. Born in Hyco, Texas on June 29, 1922, to parents Bertie and Daniel, Charlene Frances Holsey dropped out of high school in 1939 to tie the knot. Charlene married farmer Hollis Brown in Rochester, Texas, and she gave birth in 1940 to their son, Wayne. In 1942, the young family moved to Fort Worth, where Charlene's parents lived. Hollis joined the Army, and Charlene went to work in the offices of the Greyhound Bus Company, where she'd work for the next 14 years. Charlene and Hollis's union ended in tragedy when, on November 15, 1950, Hollis was killed in action in North Korea. The Army Master Sergeant's remains were never recovered. In the mid-1950s, Charlene married again, but it was short-lived and ended in annulment. By 1960, Charlene was working in accounting for a drug company, and she married for a third time that year, this time to Fred Jackson Sigler, a former minor league baseball umpire who was teaching at a school in Kennedale, a Fort Worth suburban town southeast of the city. The marriage was Fred's fourth. In 1965, Wayne, Charlene's son from her first marriage to Hollis Brown, was attending Texas Christian University in Fort Worth, and early that year, Fred left the area for Kingsland, Texas, where he was overseeing the construction of a roadside motel that he and Charlene were having built. They'd call the orange and white six-unit structure, which sat directly on Ranch Road 1431, the Highway Motel. In April of that year, with her son going to school and coming into his own, Charlene joined Fred in Kingsland. She wasn't crazy about the move. Charlene, at this point, appreciated the little big city life that Fort Worth offered and didn't care for water sports, fishing, and other outdoor activities, the very things that Kingsland was known for. Known as a small river town, Kingsland, Texas was and is a destination for tourists seeking to get away from the hustle and bustle of the city, to relax and enjoy the town's rural accommodations and the sport that the stretch of the Colorado River there has to offer. In 1950, at the edge of Kingsland and bordered by a few other towns, the Lower Colorado River Authority constructed the Granite Shoals Dam, creating a large reservoir known as Lake Granite Shoals, until its name changed to Lake Lyndon Baines Johnson, or simply Lake LBJ, in 1965. Because the 36th President's 800-acre ranch, his private retreat, was near Johnson City and close to the lake, LBJ could often be seen boating and fishing there, prompting the name change. Not long after the lake's creation, in the early 1950s, many older Texans came to the area to retire, increasing the population modestly, but also bringing with it new economic drivers and employment opportunities for the residents, like medical facilities, churches, a community center, and restaurants. Kingsland itself has and remains a small, rural town that sits at the juncture of the Colorado and Llano Rivers in Llano County. Like many Texan and American cities, the construction of railroads provided the city a place on the map, but it wasn't until Lake LBJ's creation that the area saw much of a rise in population and economy. Though neighbors of Charlene Sigler in Kingsland remarked that she seemed to, quote, have a wonderful personality, she mostly kept to herself in the first couple months she lived in the small town. Charlene and Fred spent most of their time at the Highway Motel, cleaning up construction mess and doing busy work in preparation for the motel's opening. They did go out for meals, allowing longtime locals to at least get somewhat acquainted with the new couple in town, but residents there would never get the chance to really know Charlene. 2 months after she arrived in Kingsland, and a week shy of her 44th birthday, on Tuesday, June 22, 1965, Charlene Sigler climbed in her 1955 Ford Fairlane. She was heading to Fort Worth to attend her son Wayne's Texas Christian University graduation ceremony. Charlene never made it. A week after Charlene Sigler left her Kingsland, Texas home to see her son graduate college in Fort Worth, it was the woman's 44th birthday. Her husband, Fred Sigler, found a birthday card in the mailbox for her from her son, Wayne, prompting him to telephone the young man.
"Isn't she up there?"
Wayne reported Fred asking. For years, Wayne said, they looked for Charlene day and night, but they never found anything, no leads or clues at all. In 1967, 2 years after Charlene mysteriously vanished, leaving absolutely no trace, Fred Sigler filed for divorce. A notice was placed in the newspaper, but Charlene never materialized. Fred was granted the divorce and married a few months later, only to divorce again after a few more short months. It wasn't until more than 5 years after she disappeared that Charlene Sigler's fate would be discovered. In September of 1970, the Lower Colorado River authorities began lowering Lake LBJ in preparation for the construction of a thermal power plant. As the lake continued receding, pungent odors were unleashed. Trash and other debris that had remained hidden by the murky waters for days, weeks, months, and years were now both visible and unsightly. Recent natural recession of the lake had produced far less foul results than the quick drain at the hands of man. On Friday, September 5th, 1970, after Lake LBJ had been lowered by 31 feet, the figure of an upended automobile could be seen near the northernmost arm of the body of water. The dented, rusty 1955 Ford Fairlane was dragged up the near vertical granite slope to the shoreline, settling just feet from Ranch to Market Road 1431 in Burnett County. A 1965 license plate on the car was still identifiable. The vehicle had come to rest in the water, upside down and about a mile downstream from the site of former President Lyndon Baines Johnson's boathouses near the Kingsland Bridge, in an area of the lake that is 25 feet deep under normal conditions. Law enforcement were quickly called in to inspect the scene and determine who the car belonged to. As they sifted through the silt and mud that had settled on the vehicle's headliner inside, police were startled as they found a pile of bones, human bones, just underneath the sludge. Papers and a purse also discovered within tentatively identified the remains as those of Miss Charlene Frances Sigler, who had been reported missing 5 years earlier. Charlene's bones were removed and taken to the Texas Department of Public Safety headquarters in Austin to be autopsied. After obtaining x-rays from Charlene Sigler's dentist, what was all but certain before became so when they were compared to the teeth among the remains found. The bones were positively identified as Charlene's. The surrounding community, particularly Kingsland, of course, quickly became flooded with rumor as Llano County Sheriff Porter Gale Legan suggested, and strongly, that Charlene's car hadn't ended up there as the result of an accident. His remarks to the press were somewhat contradictory, sometimes making it clear that they had no immediate clues and that it might not have been an accident, and other times insisting and asserting that it could not have possibly been an accident.
"We don't know yet if there was foul play. We'll just have to wait for the report from Austin. But from the evidence at the scene, it looked as if the car had been deliberately pushed or driven into the water,"
Sheriff Legan said, adding that there was a bluff near the Kingsland Bridge where a car could roll from and land in the deep waters below.
"The woman did not die accidentally. It was not an accident."
The reasoning behind the contradictory statements that Sheriff Legan made to the press would soon become clearer just after he canceled the missing person bulletin that he himself had issued 5 years before, on July 15, 1965. When reading the sheriff's remarks and reports that followed, hidden among comments like,
"There are no clues, this thing is very slow,"
and
The trail is pretty cold after all this time,
are comments that begin to paint a picture of the theory the lawman held. And his theory wasn't haphazardly developed.
We were called to the Highway Motel in mid-July of 1965. There was blood all over the place. We did not make an arrest at that time,
Sheriff Legan said.
It wasn't until 3 days later that Mr. Sigler reported his wife missing.
Found in Charlene's Ford Fairlane were a bevy of items that some thought suggested she was leaving Kingsland and Fred to stay elsewhere for an extended period. Her clothing, a sewing machine, an electric frying pan, a toaster, and other household goods were among the items within. It was a good starting point for a motive that perhaps she was leaving Fred, but both Charlene's mother and one of the only people who knew Charlene in Kingsland insisted that those items simply hadn't been unpacked since her arrival in April of 65. Her and Fred's one-room apartment at the Highway Motel was small, and they didn't have a lot of room for things that weren't immediately necessary. An account of the night Charlene disappeared, given by a friend of Fred Sigler, a house painter named Blackie Pittman, provided only more mystery. Charlene took her car out briefly that night, Pittman said, and returned to the motel. Upon her return, he claimed, Charlene drove into the parking lot and struck the building, loosening several concrete blocks. Pittman said Charlene was upset and told Fred she, quote, ought to run that damn Ford into the river. She drove away again sometime between 10 and 10:30 p.m., according to Pittman. He claimed that he and Fred drove around everywhere looking for Charlene for the next 3 days, even going so far as Hamilton, which is 100 miles away. The account, however, seems to contradict Charlene's son Wayne's account that when Fred received the birthday card he'd sent his mother the following week, Fred was surprised that she wasn't with him in Fort Worth. If he thought she was in Fort Worth, it seems unlikely Fred and Pittman would have searched for 3 days after Charlene drove off that night. Pittman also claimed that in nearby Marble Falls, a service station attendant said he thought Charlene had been to his station trying to buy gas with a check, but drove off without purchasing fuel after he told her he couldn't accept one. Blackie Pittman went on to say that he thinks Charlene simply lost control of the vehicle and drove into the lake. He didn't think it was murder or suicide. Charlene's mother, Bertie, agreed that it wasn't suicide. Her daughter, she said, was too proud. However, she strongly doubted that Charlene's fate was an accident. Evidence, it seems, supports Bertie's beliefs that Charlene's death was neither an accident nor suicide. Llano County Sheriff Porter Gale Legan and his investigators determined that Charlene's 1955 Ford Fairlane wasn't running when it settled into the murky waters of Lake LBJ. The key was in the ignition, but in the off position. The gear shift was in neutral. The lights were off. The windows were rolled up. No barriers or bridge railings were broken or damaged at or around the time Charlene went missing. Sheriff Legan, however, had little to no evidence to charge a suspect. Since all that remained of Charlene Sigler was a pile of bones by the time she was found, the medical examiner who performed the autopsy was unable to determine how she died. The sheriff questioned Fred Sigler, who still owned and operated the Highway Motel when his wife's remains were found, but was unable to determine much from the interview. The motel was about 2 miles from where Charlene's car and remains were found. Rumors and tall tales spread throughout Kingsland and the surrounding towns, making their way both upstream and down. Though sometimes a ring of truth can be salvaged from gossip and hearsay, it seems none could be found in the case of Charlene's death. Rumor once got around that the woman's head was missing, never found, a claim that was beyond unfounded. It was simply not true. The town talk did little more than spread fear, The locals that once felt safe from the ultra-violence found in cities like Dallas and Houston began locking their doors for the first time. Charlene Sigler was dubbed by the press the Lady in the Lake, and like Austin's Lady in the Lake discovered 5 years later, it escaped mention in newspapers in the years to come, and her story faded into cold obscurity. The case was cold, in fact, from day one, and remains so today in 2020. It wasn't until 2015 in the Highland Lakes Weekly that the story again made print in a tiny little blurb, 50 years since Charlene was last seen alive, and 45 years since she was found, and the last story ran. Fred Sigler died in 1985 in Dallas, where he lived alone in a small apartment. He'd been married and divorced several times between his death and Charlene's death. Although it's not clear precisely how long, Fred Sigler owned and continued to operate the Highway Motel for years after Charlene's car and her remains were discovered. The building, once known as the Highway Motel, still stands. It's now Willow Mist Massage Therapy. Llano County Sheriff Porter Gale Legan was a rancher and World War II vet before being elected the county's number one lawman in 1964. He retired 28 years later and lived to be 80 years old before passing away in 2008. Charlene's death likely stayed with him until the end, his only unclosed case. Don't forget to stick around to hear from our friend Steve at the podcast Fascination Street. The Austin American Statesman, the Brownwood Bulletin, the Llano News, the San Antonio Express Sun, Town & Country Magazine, TSHAOnline.org, and TexasHillCountry.com were used as sources for this episode. You can support Gone Cold at patreon.com/gonecoldpodcast. Donors at all levels there get the show ad-free, and $2.50 a month gives you access to Patreon-exclusive episodes that cover mostly solved crimes and the bad actors who perpetrated them, from the Monday afternoon murderer to the Slayer Saint. Thanks to everyone who supports us there. It's a huge help with the costs associated with producing the show, and Erica and I appreciate it beyond words. Thanks for listening, y'all.
Hey guys, this is Steve Owens from Fascination Street Podcast here with a very important message. I'm awesome. I bet you thought I was going to say something else, but nope. What's important here is that I am awesome. I have a podcast called Fascination Street, and it allows me to bring to my listeners some of the most fascinating stories and guests. I started this show because I truly believe that everybody has a story, and I'm fascinated to hear those stories. In the short time I've been doing this show, I've interviewed actors, directors, writers, inventors, podcasters, musicians, pro athletes, Olympic athletes, actual war heroes, even a Bond girl and a luthier, whatever the hell that is, and of course, regular people. From people who wanted to be stars but never gave it a real try, to big company CEOs and people who got to meet their favorite president. I love getting to meet and speak with people who have a story to tell. I feel like everyone does, and it's my job to get them to tell it. You never know who my next guest will be. An Academy Award-winning actor, a platinum-selling musician, or your own mother-in-law. But one thing is for certain, you will be fascinated by their story. So come take a walk with me down Fascination Street. You can find this show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and of course, FascinationStreetPod.com.